Hello and welcome to part 3 of the circulation and respiration module. This is part 3 and it is about assessment. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo and I cannot wait to share this information with you. So let's begin. Before we jump right into the content, I want to make sure you're aware that everything we're sharing, or I'm sharing today, is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. And I advise you, when you're talking to your clients, unless you're licensed to diagnose and treat, that you say the same, that this is really education from your research. So if you're going to use this information for yourself, make sure that you check in with anybody who's prescribed medications for you and make sure that there's a compatibility. We've already talked about how the respiratory and cardiovascular systems work. We've talked about what can go wrong. And in this presentation, we're going to talk about how do you assess the status of those systems. In part 4, we'll get to balancing protocols, which I know is the fun part for everybody, but you do have to understand the system and be able to assess it before you jump in to helping them balance. So what's the process of assessing the respiratory and cardiovascular systems? Well, like all of our other systems, it starts with understanding their signs and symptoms and doing a thorough medical history or health history. I was taught that 90% of the understanding of what's going wrong is in the history. Yeah, the tests are great, and we'll talk about the tests, but you've got to do a thorough history. And it starts with signs and symptoms and then goes into medical history, past medical history and health history and family history and all the things that we taught in our module on history taking. Next, for these systems, very important is the blood pressure. And if you're not licensed to take blood pressures and you're seeing people in person or you're seeing people over the phone or internet, then I would recommend that you talk to them about getting their own blood pressure cuff if there's any problems, if they have any history that would indicate that this could be a problem. Personally, I like to do right and left arm, and I like to do lying down, seated, and standing. And we talked a lot about the orthostatic measurement of blood pressure in our adrenal module. Pulse is super important. You want them to be in that nice average range, you know, 60 to 72. If they're lower than that and they're not an elite athlete, then you're suspicious that something might be wrong. If they're higher than that and they didn't just race to your office and rush up the stairs, and it's typically that, then it's something to be considering. VO2 max, that's the maximum capacity that the lungs can handle, that your body is able to take in during very intense exercise. And this requires equipment that doctor's offices have, certain clinics have, hospitals may have, and also some health clubs have. Arterial blood gas. Now, we're going to go in, they're going to measure the amount of carbon dioxide and oxygen in the blood. Arterial blood is a little bit different in collection than venous blood. Then there's the blood test. So we're going to go into very good detail about the blood tests for both respiratory systems and cardiovascular. Next is auscultation. What does that mean? Auscultation is the listening to the sounds. And you can do this for both the respiratory and the cardiovascular system. So listen to the heart, listen at the valves. Then there's a way to listen over the lungs. You're listening for breath sounds. So if you're not licensed to do exams on people, you're just not going to be doing these things, but you could ask questions about it. I just want you to understand all the different assessment tools that are available. EKG. That's something that's the measure of the waves of the heart. And I have a picture of the EKG results a little bit later. And you may just ask, have you ever had an EKG, right? So you're trying to get at, have they had any kind of serious problem that you need to be aware of? Imaging, chest x-rays, those are done when there's a suspicion of bronchitis or pneumonia. On bronchitis, the x-ray is going to be completely clear, and that helps you rule out pneumonia. There's something called the acoustic cardiogram, and I gave you a little reference to it, which is similar to an echocardiogram. It's newer technology, and based on the article there, It's easier to do and it's more reliable. Then there's the stress test, where they get on like a treadmill and are exercised to max capacity, and then they are tested. They're tested during it to see how the heart is doing and how it's withstanding. These can be dangerous for someone who already has a diagnosed condition, or who has an undiagnosed but present condition where there's some blockages there. So, you know, people need to be careful about that. Finally, there's Doppler, and Doppler is usually used on the extremity to listen for peripheral vascular disease, to listen for clots, to listen for an inability of the blood flow to be going back up to the heart. Let's get a little bit more detailed on a lot of these. So, signs and symptoms of cardiovascular and respiratory disease. I'm going to review these. We went over these in our What Can Go Wrong section, part two. So if you need to go back there and listen as well. Calf pain on exertion, which can be a sign of a blood clot in the leg. Muscle cramps on exertion. The muscles are not getting enough oxygen. Swelling of the extremities can actually be quite dangerous. Well, if it's just edema during pregnancy, it's often related to that. It could be swelling because the person is obese and there's a lot of pressure and the venous return isn't happening real well. But it is an alert for congestive heart failure, especially if it's bluish. Chest pain and tightness in chest. To differentiate chest pain that's related to musculoskeletal versus chest pain that's related to the heart, angina or true heart attack, you've got to ask questions. The chest pain that's related to angina or a heart attack is usually a tightening. So angina is short-lived, it's only for a short period of time, but with a heart attack, it goes on, and it also is very severe in terms of the quality, or very specific. It's said to be like an elephant is sitting on your chest, just really tight. The other thing about it to differentiate from musculoskeletal is it's not affected by movement. It doesn't get better, it doesn't get worse by changing position, moving the arms, taking a deep breath. It's just there. With a musculoskeletal chest pain, what it is usually something in the intercostal muscles or tightness of the diaphragm, or it can even be some of the muscles that go into the chest wall. So that would be related to position. So if a person raises their arms, puts their arm back, does some extensive work and the chest pain gets worse, it's likely to be a musculoskeletal situation. People can have irregular heartbeats. That could be a congenital thing. That could be related to valve defects. Heartbeats may be very erratic. Shortness of breath with moderate exertion. Sure, you expect people to get shortness of breath when they're running and they're doing extensive cardiovascular exercise. But when people get very short of breath, when they're going to the refrigerator to get another beer, that's a problem. Air hunger. Gasping for air. That's a sign of cardiovascular. Heavy, irregular breathing. That's usually a sign of air hunger. It's also a sign of a problem with breathing. It could be a musculoskeletal thing where the diaphragm isn't moving, but it's something that needs to be reported and they need to be checked out. Rapid breathing and confusion, right? That can be a sign of, again, low oxygenation of the blood, so the person needs to be breathing more rapidly. You will find that a lot of folks will rapid breathe whenever they're stressed, and that shallow rapid breathing is a stress response, and they're actually not breathing properly. They're not using their diaphragm to breathe. They're actually using the muscles, the scalenes that are in the neck, and they end up with some neck pain and neck stiffness. So that combination of rapid breathing with the neck stiffness is usually stress breathing. Redness of their face for no apparent reason. It happens when people exert, their face can get red. It happens when they have rosacea or other skin diseases or systemic diseases, but for no reason. There's nothing else that could be a sign of a cardiovascular problem. So let's talk about coughing. is an indication of a respiratory problem. It could be in the larynx, it could be in the bronchi, it could be in the lungs. We typically associate that with a condition where there's just coughing and there's mucus and there's all sorts of other indications of an upper respiratory or lower respiratory illness. But when they're coughing at night and they don't have an illness, that can be a problem, and we want to be investigating that and looking for other signs of cardiovascular respiratory situation. Fatigue, lethargy, and sleepiness. Well, those can be associated with a lot of things, right? Those aren't differentials for this system. But if you've ruled out other things, then you just need to think about the cardiovascular system as a possibility. If they lose consciousness, that's definitely going to point you towards cardiovascular respiratory, and that's serious and they need to be evaluated. Cyanosis is a bluish color. It could be in the lips, the skin, the nails, and that's a sign of lack of oxygenation to the tissue. And then finally, pallor. So what are you going to do with this list of symptoms, all right? Obviously, it could be a checklist that you have on your form. We have forms for you that have a lot of these. So then you can see, well, do they have a possibility of a cardiovascular respiratory system? I recommend we don't sit for hours and hours asking people about these. You include these kind of symptoms on a checklist, and then you're going to go, okay, this fatigue in conjunction with other symptoms related to cardiovascular or other things in their family history makes me suspicious, and we want to get it checked out. Or this fatigue is probably related to their low thyroid function. There are additional physical signs that you can look for, and this comes from applied kinesiology. This is something that's not a quote-unquote standardized medical approach, but it's something you can use. You can ask them, do they have tenderness at the left second intercostal space? The intercostal spaces are spaces between the ribs. So you go to that left one right near the sternum. So you go to the left side right near the sternum, and if that's tender, it's a possibility that there's some cardiovascular stuff going on. Tenderness in 1 inch up and 1 inch out from the navel. Just ask them to palpate. Tenderness at spinal levels T1 and T2. These are, again, they're not specific for cardiovascular. It's just yet another clue when we're putting together the picture. Now, we're going to go through the cardiovascular blood markers. We all know what total cholesterol is, and total cholesterol has been used as an indicator of cardiovascular disease for a long time. However, it's very limited, and we're going to talk later about some other things that we should be looking at, because their cholesterol can be perfectly fine, but the subparticles and the lipoproteins can be out of balance, and that's going to be a problem. So the HDLs take the cholesterol away from the cells. We measure those. We like to see those higher. I like to see them 75 would be a really nice number to target for. LDLs are the low-density lipoproteins. They deposit the cholesterol back into the artery walls. We'll look at some more other things that it does as well. It's always considered the bad cholesterol, but it actually has some redeeming value, and we're going to look at subfractions, particles, under the LDL to show you how to really evaluate. VLDL is very low-density lipoproteins. It's a little bit of protein and lots of fat. That's the most dangerous. Cholesterol HDL ratio is used a lot to determine risk factor. However, there's other things that should be used. Is actually the triglyceride HDL ratio is more important. Triglyceride HDL ratio is usually associated with insulin resistance, but we'll see later that it can also be associated with cardiac risk. Because why? Insulin resistance is related to cardiac risk. Triglycerides are the fat, and they provide energy. They're the stored form of fat. That's when we can't get the fat into the cells and insulin resistance. It gets converted to triglycerides. But also when there's excess calories consumed, they can get converted to triglycerides to store it. Highly sensitive CRP is a marker for vascular inflammation. Homocysteine PROS is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. That's a byproduct of the methylation cycles. And when we don't have enough B vitamins, we end up with high homocysteine, which is also a risk factor, by the way, for brain dysfunction. Apolipoproteins are another measure of cardiovascular health. They are the proteins that surround the lipids to make the lipoproteins. Apolipoprotein A is in the HDL. Apolipoprotein B is in the LDL. And the last general marker we're going to look at is creatine kinase. And CK or CPK is sometimes called. And it's a protein that is an enzyme that's released in to the bloodstream after a heart attack. And you can generally see that if there's a suspicion that somebody had a mild heart attack, but not sure, they can run a creatine kinase right away and be able to tell. And usually it's elevated for about 24 hours. Let's take a look at some respiratory blood markers. There's not quite as many, and there's some of them that you've heard of and some of them you may not associate with the respiration system. You measure the blood gases, and that's typically done through arterial blood sample. Carbon dioxide is actually measured in the standard routine CBC chem panel, the carbon dioxide level, and it can be an indication of the pH. So I often use it if the CO2 is elevated, then it shows more of an alkaline condition. If it's reduced, it shows more of an acidic condition. Chloride's one of the electrolytes. It's high in respiratory alkalosis, and it's low in respiratory distress. And then there's the white blood cells, which would indicate if there's an infection, right? So if you're suspicious, does somebody have a viral or a bacterial infection, you can run a white blood cell count with differentials and see what the neutrophil lymphocyte ratios are. There's also imaging that can be done. We mentioned a few of these on a previous slide, but the imaging that can be done for assessing cardiovascular system, it's expensive and it's also intensive. So it's not done when there's just a minor situation. It's done when there's a suspicion that something's really wrong. First one that we'll talk about for imaging is the electrocardiogram. And it's often called the ECG or the EKG. And you can see the little picture in red, and that shows the wave of what a normal heart would be. So what they're looking for is rhythm irregularities. The echocardiogram and the acoustic cardiogram are where they're using sound waves to superimpose on an EKG to detect if there's abnormalities in the heart. The CMR, cardiac magnetic resonance imaging, is basically done with a contrast dye. So any of these that are done with contrast dyes tend to be more invasive. They're injecting various chemicals into the blood so they can watch it on an imaging. Angiogram, they're inserting dye and looking to see if there are blockages in the artery. And that's one of the main ways that they'll detect, that somebody has two or three or four of their coronary arteries blocked and the percentage of occlusion that's occurring. There's also CT and MRI scan. They're not done as frequently. Then there's a PET scan to determine if there's blockages, and the Doppler ultrasound, which is usually done on the extremities. Cholesterol has gotten a bad rap. It's considered the bad guy. But is it really the bad guy? Is it something our body produces just to hurt us? It's got to have a function, right? It's just excess and also oxidized cholesterol that can be a problem, and the subparticles, which we're going to get into a lot of detail on in a bit. Cholesterol actually is used to build and maintain cell membranes, the outer layer of the cell membranes. It's important for controlling the permeability of the cell membranes. Cholesterol is a precursor to the steroid hormones. What are those? Well, there's the sex hormones, progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, but there's also the adrenal hormones, cortisol, aldosterone, and DHEA. And so if we don't have enough cholesterol, we don't get enough hormones. So it's really not the bad guy. It's just when it's in excess and when it's oxidized. And I'll repeat that a lot. It's also important for fat-soluble vitamin synthesis. It converts sunshine to vitamin D. That's pretty darn important, isn't it? It aids in the production of bile. Well, bile's pretty darn important because we need to digest fats. It insulates nerve fibers. The brain has got a lot of cholesterol in it. It helps to form a cushion around the nerves. It's also an important antioxidant, which people don't realize. It actually is protective. When the liver sends out cholesterol into the bloodstream, it's going to repair some damage there. That's what people don't realize. It's when the cholesterol gets oxidized and it gets stuck in those damaged areas that plaques can form. So let's look at lipoproteins, right? We talked a lot about this in our first part, the whole anatomy, physiology, and how the system works. But as a reminder, lipoproteins are lipid particles that transport the cholesterol. These are the HDLs and the LDL. The LDL takes cholesterol to the body. The HDL takes it back to the liver. Then we have the apoproteins, which are proteins that have the lipoproteins in the center. And those are important because the only way that cholesterol can be transported is with protein, because the blood is a liquid, right? Water and oil don't mix, remember that? So we can't just float cholesterol through the body. It has to be attached to a protein. Cholesterol itself doesn't cause heart disease. It's the oxidized cholesterol that causes a major problem. And when we eat trans fats and we have a lot of free radical damage, the cholesterol gets oxidized. When people cook eggs and fry them, the cholesterol gets mixed with air and it's oxidized. So there's a lot of ways to keep cholesterol safe. It's just the standard American diet doesn't do that. When we have increased inflammation in the body, the cholesterol modules get oxidized, triglycerides are formed, and the blood walls get damaged. And this is really key. Only recently have the medical doctors actually started to test for highly sensitive C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker. Well, let's look at a little bit more detail about the HDL and the LDL. And we talked a little bit about this in the first part of this module. LDL is typically called the bad cholesterol. Why is it called LDL cholesterol? Well, remember, it's attached to the cholesterol. The lipoprotein is attached to the cholesterol, and it's associated with arterial plaque. But it's not 100% bad. It's sent out for a reason. It helps to transport important fat-soluble nutrients into the cells, like vitamin A, E, D, CoQ10, carotenoids, and some antioxidants. It helps to protect the transported lipids from oxidative damage. It gets oxidized, but it protects the nutrients from getting oxidized. And the other thing we need to consider about LDL, and we're going to go into more detail in a little bit, is that the size and the concentration of the LDL particles makes a huge difference. There's the large particles, there's the small particles. The small particles are associated with a higher degree of atherosclerosis. The larger ones are more protective. So it's really important to be testing the particles, not just the whole LDL. Let's talk a little bit about high sensitivity C-reactive protein. CRP increases during systemic inflammation. It's not just associated with cardiovascular inflammation. It can be elevated when there's inflammation in the rest of the body. So it's often used as an autoimmune marker. It can be elevated when you've got the flu. It's a systemic inflammatory marker. It's associated with lower survival rates in people with unstable angina and heart attack. So if somebody has a heart attack and they have low CRP, they're going to survive longer, statistically speaking, than someone with high hsCRP. High levels of CRP help to predict the prognosis and the risk of another cardiac event, especially in people who already have had a stroke, peripheral artery disease, or have already had a heart attack. So somebody goes ahead and has a bypass surgery or has some intervention and they have elevated highly sensitive CRP, there's going to be a high risk of a recurrence. So it's really important that we work with people on inflammation. We'll harp this over and over. Almost every disease that we know of, all the killer diseases, are associated with inflammation. And inflammation is very controllable via what? Guess what? Diet and lifestyle, nutrients. Those people who have their hsCRP in the upper third of the range, double the risk of those in the lower levels. This is significant. I like to see the CRP somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.3 to 0.5 for ideal health. There have been studies that have shown an association with sudden death, peripheral artery disease, and highly sensitive CRP. I wish my mom's doctors had tested her for high sensitivity CRP. I wish they'd done this because she was probably at risk. I wish they'd done a detailed cardio panel like we're going to talk about in a little bit, because she didn't have any diagnosed heart problems, but she died suddenly. My guess is that her CRP was elevated. My guess is that insulin resistance had caused damage to her arteries. My knowing probably is that her cigarette smoking had damaged the arterial linings. And that's what caused her to just suddenly die. She didn't have a diagnosis. So this is important. Like, we don't just want to work on improving heart function, cardiovascular function in the folks who already have heart disease. We want to improve it in everyone, especially if they have a family history of it. Homocysteine is an intermediate product that gets produced in the methylation cycle. If a person has enough B vitamins, they can then convert the homocysteine down the pathways and eventually into glutathione. If they don't have enough B6, B12, and folate, they get a buildup of homocysteine. What does that cause? Well, it causes damage to the cardiovascular system, can damage the lining of the arteries. It can also cause a problem in the brain. It can damage delicate brain tissue. There's a genetic predisposition. The MTHFR C677T is one of those risk factors. The cool part about this is that you can get this decreased very, very quickly if the person is compliant. You put them on B6, B12, and folate. You get them on a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables, especially the green leafies, because they're an excellent source of folate. That can lower homocysteine rather quickly. Much of the media and all the literature talks about high cholesterol and the dangers of high cholesterol. But what about the low cholesterol? As we said, low cholesterol can be a risk factor for hormone imbalance. It can be a risk factor for brain imbalance because it's so important for the lining of the vessels. What kind of things can cause the cholesterol to go too low? Well, heavy metal overload, chemical overload, congestion in the gallbladder or gallbladder removal, congestion in the bile ducts. Very low fat intake can contribute to low cholesterol. Why? Because, well, cholesterol is made in the liver, but we have to have fat in order to make it. A lot of folks say, well, we should always have cholesterol in the diet. We don't need to have cholesterol in the diet. Strict vegans have good heart health as long as they eat enough fat. I believe that very, very low fat diets can be dangerous because we're not supplying enough of the precursors to make cholesterol and to make a lot of other things that are related to fat. Another thing that can cause low cholesterol is hyperthyroid. We know that hypothyroid contributes to high cholesterol levels. Sometimes when we're looking at somebody who has extremely good diet and they have high cholesterol, we want to be suspicious about hypothyroid. And we don't just mean hypothyroid that's clinically diagnosable on a blood test by high TSH. No, we mean the subtle signs. We mean all the things we talked about in the thyroid module related to conversion issues, related to receptor issues. And then also an autoimmune process can damage the cholesterol. So those can be contributing factors to low cholesterol, which may not be as immediately dangerous in terms of risk of heart attack to high cholesterol, but it's dangerous in that it contributes to the bad quality of life. And it can be dangerous in terms of leading to dysfunction in the hormones in the brain.